From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This is Josh Barrow, and you're listening to a special series from Left, Right, and Center. LRC presents All the President's Lawyers. Yes, a special series. We've been doing these weekly side conversations with our lawyer, Ken White, and we decided to make it a regular thing. There is enough news about law, libel, and litigation surrounding the president to fill its own weekly show. So please, make sure to subscribe. We won't be sending this out to the regular Left, Right, and Center podcast feed anymore. So go on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to LRC Presents All the President's Lawyers. But enough about us. Let's proceed with this week's show. I am joined by Ken White. Ken, as you know, is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. Ken blogs about the law at popehat.com and hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Josh.
So let's start with a quiz. On Wednesday morning, President Trump tweeted this. He starts quoting someone, "There are lots of really good lawyers in the country, and he could have picked anybody else." Then the president adds, "And I wish I did." Which of his lawyers is this tweet about?
There's so many it could be about, but in this particular case, it's about the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions.
I woke up this morning, I read this tweet, I assumed it was about Michael Cohen, but no, it was not.
Yeah, and I might have gone with Giuliani, Josh, as
yes.
My first guess. But this is fairly typical of the President of the United States now, complaining about his lawyers. But let's point out that the man picked Jeff Sessions, the man picked Michael Cohen, the man picked Rudy Giuliani. And sooner or later, when you pick a series of bad lawyers, it might not be about the lawyers. It might be about
right.
You.
I mean, like, unless you're an indigent defendant, you're not having a lawyer foisted upon you. You are choosing.
Well, exactly. Sometimes I get cold calls from people who want to hire me because they want to sue their last three or four lawyers. And I generally tend to think of that situation that the problem may not be with the lawyers.
So why is the president complaining about Jeff Sessions this week?
Well, this is part of the president's continuing gripe that Sessions was wrong to recuse himself from involvement in the special counsel investigation. Sessions, at the very beginning, recused himself and took himself out of the chain of supervision of Rod Rosenstein because his behavior might possibly be part of the inquiry. And President Trump has been upset about that for a while. He wishes his loyalists were in control and supervising ultimately the investigation through and over Rod Rosenstein. And this is part of his complaint.
Isn't that so? Before we get into there's this New York Times story this week about the president actually having asked Jeff Sessions to unrecuse himself. But isn't this exactly what a recusal is for a situation where you might be concerned that the prosecutor would show favoritism toward the person who's being investigated or a person who is involved in the matter that's being investigated?
Well, yes. I mean, Sessions' recusal is not exactly about favoritism towards Trump. He didn't admit that he would be loyal to Trump or biased in favor of Trump. The issue.
Well, but he said that he was recused because he'd been involved in the presidential campaign.
Exactly.
Even before it became clear that Sessions might actually be someone who would be a witness in the inquiry. It was simply about him having been a campaign surrogate for the president.
Well, exactly. Well, he was a potential witness under any definition, even with what we knew about the investigation a year ago. He recognized, and I think responsibly and professionally, that it was not something that he should be in the loop on. And I think that the president's more sort of business/CEO-style approach to being president, that was something he didn't like. He, of course, you want somebody who's in your corner in a position of power. And the sort of ethical Department of Justice rules and regs weren't something that he respected or understood.
And he also, one thing we learned in this New York Times story was he said that he believes that, you know, Eric Holder protected Barack Obama from these sorts of things. So this is not only the way that he wants to operate the Department of Justice, he believes that this is how prior presidents also operated the Department of Justice. But I want to ask about this Times story, because we've known for months that the president has been raging about this recusal decision. Did we learn things that are new and important in this story where it was disclosed that the president had actually explicitly last March asked Jeff Sessions to undo his own recusal and take back over supervision of the Russia investigation?
Well, I think that we learned something a little more specifically than we knew before, that it was something that was widely suspected and speculated about. And this was, although it's, you know, from undisclosed sources, this was a story that portrayed very specifically what the president did, and, you know, very intentionally going to Sessions and telling him, I want you to be back in control of this and I want to have a loyalist doing this. So this really tees up more directly the question that you and I talked about before, which is, can a president, in exercising his constitutional powers like appointment, obstruct justice? Because if he were not the president, and if he were, going in and trying to get people to change their mind to control an investigation for his benefit, that very much could be obstruction of justice.
Does the fact that that Mueller is looking into this, we know that Sessions sat for an interview with Mueller earlier this year, does that tell us anything about the breadth of the investigation that we didn't know before? Is it that, you know, that there might be more things that he's looking at that could be obstruction than we realized?
Again, I think it's more about confirming what we already suspected. It already appeared that investigation, the scope of it included whether or not the president did things to obstruct the investigation, whether it was firing Comey or anything else to interfere in what Mueller was doing. And this story, if it's credited, just seems to confirm that. But the fact that Mueller is looking into it doesn't mean that he's determined that it was a crime or that it's anything he can do. It just it shows a fairly typical federal criminal investigation, which is let's go down all the roads that we see and look for all the evidence we could find and make a determination at the end about what was done.
There was another way that the president's Twitter got into the news this past week, which is that a federal judge ruled that the president can't block people on Twitter, that if he does so, that violates their First Amendment right to respond publicly to him. This decision sounds ridiculous to me. Is it?
You know, it sounded ridiculous to me initially, too. But on further reflection, I think it's not. It's a 75-page decision. It is not the most perfectly clearly written one I've ever seen. I had to read it three times before I was confident that I understood it, and I'm a First Amendment lawyer. But yes, there is actually in there the core of a reasonable theory. And basically, it's this. I don't know how many of our listeners use Twitter, but if you don't, on Twitter, you have the option to screen out people you find obnoxious. And there are a couple of ways to do it. One is to mute, which just means that if you mute someone, they can rail away at you and yell at you and say things to you and read your account, but you don't hear anything they say. The other way is to block. And if you block someone, then they can't read the content you put on Twitter and they can't respond to it. What the judge said was this, that when the government uses Twitter in an official government way, then it creates a space that's a public forum. And that space is the opportunity to respond to the government, to say things back to the government, and engage in a dialogue with the government. And this was a really much narrower ruling than people are saying. So Twitter, of course, is a private institution, and the First Amendment doesn't bind private institutions. So it's absolutely clear and explicit that this decision doesn't mean that Twitter is bound by the First Amendment. What it means is that the government is bound by the First Amendment, so that when it creates a space for dialogue called a public forum, then it can't limit that forum based on viewpoint. An analogy you might use is this. If the government rents out a private theater for a government event, for a talk, a dialogue that's going to be a public forum, it can't then screen out all Democrats or Republicans or screen out people out of that theater based on viewpoint. Even though it's a private theater, they've used it for a public event. The next day, the private theater can screen out people based on viewpoint if it wants because it's not the government. So what the judge said here was that, first of all, it was completely clear that the president has been using Twitter in an official capacity. The Twitter account is labeled as the president's official account. He does governmental functions on there, talking about official things, and he, he uses it the way the president of the United States might normally use a podium at the White House. And because of that, the space that that creates, kind of an imaginary virtual space, which is the ability to hit reply and respond to that tweet, is a public forum. And because of that, it's subject to certain constitutional limitations.
So here's the issue I take with that. When we say that when the president blocks you, that means you can't reply to him. I mean, that means a specific technical thing about how Twitter works. You can still see the president's tweets. You can log out and see them. You can still write whatever you want about what he has said on Twitter, and that's public and searchable and viewable. What the block does is it means that in the way that Twitter is formatted, your reply tweet will not show up in a thread below the president's original tweet that you are objecting to. And that's the thing that I don't understand how that can be construed as a public forum. Now, Twitter itself may be a public forum, and if the president could, like, literally prevent you from talking about him on Twitter, I understand why that would be a First Amendment violation. But isn't this when, if the president effectively curates whose replies to him can be seen by other people, isn't this akin to, like, if the White House issues a press release including favorable quotes about itself from, you know, members of the public who have said nice things about the president? You have no First Amendment right to show up in that press release alongside the people who said nice things about him. That press release is government speech, and the government is allowed to say certain things and not say other things. So shouldn't the block be like that? Shouldn't it basically be, you know, the president is saying, I don't like your replies, and so I am removing your replies from my own page. That is my speech function by deciding what things are said about me that I am going to amplify. That doesn't sound to me like a free speech violation.
It's a good point, Josh, and that may be one of the more stretching parts of this opinion. So the way the judge handled that issue is this. The judge said very clearly that what the president puts in the tweets is not a public forum. You don't have any right to dictate what the president tweets. The thing that the president doesn't have the right to do, according to the judge, is to use this mechanism of Twitter to determine whether or not you can respond in this space that's been created. Again, the problem here fundamentally is that we're applying old doctrines to new technology, and there's a lot of law is analogy-based. And whenever you try to use the old analogies based on ancient technology like parks and sidewalks that are public forums to new cutting-edge technology, you always have these growing pains. Again, to use a better analogy, it might be like this. Imagine that private theater again that the government hires out in order to do a public forum. And imagine that a large part of the theater has obstructed seats that can't see the stage, and there are no microphones up there to ask questions during question time. And the government puts all the people whose viewpoints they don't like in that section. That's kind of like what the court says the president is doing here. And what the court points out is that even though this may be a very small burden on speech, because as you said, someone can just log into another account or there's other ways of reading what the president said or even responding to it, that in public forum law, even very small burdens on speech are enough to make it unconstitutional.
Does this opinion apply to public officials, you know, all the way down to water commissioner? If I'm some low-level public official and there are trolls in the community who bother me, am I now not allowed to block them on Twitter because of this decision?
Only to the extent that you use Twitter for your official function. So the opinion says explicitly that government officials who have private accounts aren't bound on those private accounts. They can block whoever they want. And this case is fairly fact-specific. I think that the president and the administration have gone to rather extraordinary lengths to make his Twitter account notably public, notably official. So I think that will be a factual determination based on each particular governmental account. But one thing I think you're right is that it does leave open some questions, which is that if the First Amendment applies, then where does that leave trolls or people just screaming obscenities exactly? You know, when can you moderate? When can you curate? I don't think those things are entirely clear, and I think there's probably going to be more litigation over it.
We also had more this week of Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, trying to set terms for any potential Trump-Mueller interview. He says he wants to be able to review all the FBI documents about the confidential source who talked to the FBI about Trump campaign advisors in 2016. This is the thing the president has been on about, calling it Spygate, although there's no basis for the president's assertion that the informant was inserted into the campaign. What do you think Giuliani is up to here with this demand?
Well, it could be a couple of things. It could be he wants to see what he can get away with. Now, almost nobody gets to see the evidence before they sit down and get questioned by authorities. The only people who try are people with a lot of power in the situation or a lot of chutzpah. Since the special counsel is likely to be willing to negotiate a certain amount in order to get the president to sit down without litigation, And it may just be also, in addition, Josh, setting up an excuse for refusing to let the president submit to questioning, saying we made a reasonable request, even though it's manifestly not reasonable, and they didn't give it to us, so that's why we're not doing it.
Yeah, I mean, this is another situation where it's unclear where the president's legal strategy ends and his PR strategy begins. And one thing that I think is particularly interesting about this example is, you know, the president has made this big public stink about this informant, this guy, Stefan Halper, who we misidentified on a recent show as a professor at Oxford. He's actually an emeritus professor at Cambridge, but he's this guy who's been around the, you know, U.S. diplomatic apparatus for a long time. And it, my sense of it is that probably the information that came from him is not that central to this investigation. It's sort of, you know, he was talking about what, you know, Trump campaign advisors were up to during the campaign, these guys who were sort of on the periphery, like, you know, like George Papadopoulos. But I can never quite tell when the president is on about some conspiracy. It's not always just something he's made up as a public argument. Often these are things he believes. And I wonder if the president really thinks that whatever this informant came up with is super central to the investigation, is the most important thing for him to know, rather than just being one among many, many, many pieces of evidence that might cause trouble for him in an interview.
Well, this has been the problem with covering the Trump administration from the very start, trying to decide when something is strategy or when something is just Trump being Trump. And I honestly don't know here. I think this could just be the bugaboo in his head, or it could be some sort of deep strategy about how he's trying to push this narrative of the spy, and this is just yet another vehicle of pushing that narrative, or it could be some mix of all those things. But I don't think we should always assume that there's strategy behind it rather than, you know, bile.
When you say that, you know, that Mueller might be inclined to negotiate with the president here in order to get him to sit down without litigation, because that litigation, even if Mueller thought he might win and be able to force the president to sit, that it would be time consuming and risky. Isn't the problem here that the president is completely untrustworthy? So you might, you know, have some negotiation over terms for a sit down and give something up to the president, like you let him review some files you wouldn't otherwise let him review, and then the president will just renege and decline to sit for the interview anyway?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it would be completely foolish to turn over anything with an expectation that he would, you know, keep an agreement and then sit down because you gave it to him. I would expect whatever it is to be selectively leaked, with the parts that are good for the president released and the rest hidden. But Mueller's not a dummy, so I doubt he'll fall for that. And, you know, Giuliani may know he's not going to fall for it, which weighs in favor of this being more a public messaging approach rather than a real substantive deal point.
Let's take a short break. Right after, Ken White and I will talk about Michael Avenatti. We're back. On Tuesday, Michael Avenatti produced what he says are emails from Keith Davidson. That's Stormy Daniels' former lawyer, the one Avenatti claims failed to appropriately represent Daniels' interests and instead colluded with Michael Cohen. One email from Davidson was sent to a Wall Street Journal reporter just days before the 2016 election. In it, Davidson denies that he has ever represented any person adverse to Donald Trump. Note, obviously not true. And he further threatens to sue the Wall Street Journal for defamation if they say that he has represented such a person. Another email is him forwarding the threat he had sent to the Journal to Michael Cohen, with an FYI at the top. So, Ken, here's my first question. Obviously, it's not illegal to lie to a reporter, and it's not illegal to make BS lawsuit threats. But Davidson is a member of the bar. Is any of this an ethics violation, threatening to file a defamation suit that you have no intention of filing over a claim that you know is actually true?
You could make an argument that it's a violation of legal ethics, but it's not the sort that is generally prosecuted or sanctioned by the bar, because if they did, they'd be constantly doing nothing but that. So even though it's, I think, very damaging to Davidson's reputation and ought to be, that it comes out that he was blatantly lying in this legal threat, it's not likely anything he's going to face any official consequences for.
What about telling Cohen about the fact that he'd made the threat? Because it seems to me like this might be a situation where Trump and Daniels, the two clients of these lawyers, actually had an aligned interest. They'd entered into this confidential agreement, and they might both have an interest in keeping the agreement secret from the Wall Street Journal. So could it then make sense that they would coordinate on this reaction?
Well, it might make sense if he's being very cautious and defensive. So if the agreement has harsh penalties, the way Stormy Daniels' agreement did, then Davidson might have an interest in making sure he conveys to Cohen, look at how well I'm complying with this. I'm denying everything. I'm not revealing anything. We're doing everything obligated under this hush money agreement. So that could be the purpose of that. Or there could be something more sinister in terms of coordinating with Cohen. I mean, there's a lot of weird skullduggery going on here with these agreements.
How could Michael Avenatti have come into possession of these emails?
That's an excellent question. We don't know what communications he's had in the past with Keith Davidson. We don't know whether or not Keith Davidson's former client, Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, who's now Avenatti's client, might have had possession of them and given them to Avenatti. There's any number of ways he could have gotten them. And, you know, you wonder also, what's his play now in revealing them? Is, you know, Davidson now on the bad guy side in his mind, or is this more of an effort to show Cohen's involvement? You know, he's got some sort of play there, and it's just not clear what it is yet.
Avenatti released this email after the Wall Street Journal ran a story on Tuesday under the headline, "Stormy Daniels Lawyer Michael Avenatti Complicates Michael Cohen Probe." And so the allegation in this Wall Street Journal story is that basically Avenatti has been slow walking waivers of privilege that the New York U.S. Attorney's Office would like to get from Stormy Daniels. Basically, they want to look at Daniels' own communications with her former lawyer, Keith Davidson. They also may want to look at communications between Daniels and her former manager, Gina Rodriguez. In order for this to happen, she needs to waive attorney-client privilege. And they say that basically Avenatti has been failing to produce that waiver. What do you make of this story?
You know, I don't think that it is in any way sinister. If you are a responsible attorney representing a client and federal prosecutors want your client to waive attorney-client privilege and look at your client's prior communications with their lawyers, you're going to make 200% certain that nothing in those communications is harmful, and there's no way this could take a bad bounce against your client. Any lawyer who knew what they were doing would want to take it very cautiously and review every communication and chase down every possible way that any of this could get your client in trouble. The problem here, from Avenatti's viewpoint, is that he's been so aggressive in the press, so much, what do these people have to hide? And, you know, look at how they're targets of an investigation, and we're going to do absolutely everything we can to bring the truth to light, that there's a big conflict between his public stance, which is very aggressive, and this private responsible stance, which is very slow, cautious, and let's protect the client. So he's really kind of, again, the victim of his own public campaign on this point.
There are a couple of other news items this week that I would love your take on what they mean. The special master in New York, that's the retired judge who's been dealing with the results of the search of Michael Cohen's home and office and hotel room, looking through the documents and taking objections from Cohen's attorneys or the president's attorneys about what's subject to attorney-client privilege. In the first set of documents she's gone through, there are 296 items where Cohen or the president has asserted attorney-client privilege. There are also well over a million items where there has been no assertion of privilege. What is an item? I feel like if you searched my home and office, you would not find over 1 million discrete pieces of evidence. Am I wrong about that?
You're totally wrong. So this whole thing and the way the media is framing this, I almost wish I still had hair so I could tear it out because it's driving me absolutely crazy.
Sorry, Ken.
An item is anything that can be separated from anything else. So one email can be an item, and by that I mean your email to me is an item, my reply to you is an item, your response to that reply is an item. Sometimes every attachment to an email is a separate item. Sometimes your signature graphic in an email is a separate item. Every piece of paper in your house that gets taken is an item. Add to that the fact that when the feds go and search someplace, you know, people have this like TV image where they go in and they say, oh, this is a smoking gun document. We're taking this. In reality, they just go in and they take everything. And this is always a problem for prosecutors. You know, when I was a federal prosecutor, before a big search, I would sit with the agents for hours saying, look, this is the list of what you're allowed to take. You are only allowed to take things on this list, nothing else. Let's go through this list carefully. These are the items that are relevant. And I'd give it to them, and 2 days later, they'd come back, you know, tails wagging like enthusiastic golden retrievers saying, look, all the stuff we got. And it's just tons and tons of documents that have nothing whatsoever to do with the list. They just take everything.
But so if your office was raided and immense numbers of documents were taken out and they were not relevant or probative, still I would think an enormous number of them would be privileged because you're an attorney and you generate a lot of privileged documents in your work. Does it say anything that there are, you know, only, you know, 300 odd documents on which they've chosen actually to assert a privilege?
Well, that's relatively consistent with what people have been arguing before, that Michael Cohen only had a few legal clients and he was doing very limited legal work for them. Josh, the privilege is relatively narrow. It's not just anything a lawyer does. It's only confidential communications with the client and just the client. So if someone like Michael Cohen is doing business work with clients and or if he's doing communications that are copied to non-clients or anything like that, then a lot of that is not going to be privileged. But again, if the government raids your office, a lawyer's office, then because they're going to seize absolutely everything, lawyers generate a lot of paper, business people generate a lot of paper, and the vast majority of it is going to be non-privileged.
We also learned this week that Robert Mueller is moving to sentence Richard Pinedo, who pleaded guilty to felony identity fraud for selling bank account numbers to Russian trolls who then used the accounts to buy social media ads related to the presidential election. Last week, Mueller filed a similar request for a pre-sentencing report on George Papadopoulos. That's the Trump campaign foreign policy advisor slash coffee boy who pleaded guilty to lying to federal investigators. What does it mean that Mueller is ready for these guys to be sentenced?
Probably it means that he doesn't envision that they will be cooperating further and that not only is their cooperation completed, but the consequences of their cooperation is completed. And that's an important distinction. So that means not only is it true that, you know, he's not going to call them as witnesses, he's not going to ask them follow-up questions, he doesn't envision they'll be continuing useful sources of information about an ongoing investigation, but it also means that he thinks he can tell the judge, this is how they helped and this is the impact of how they helped, period, end of sentence. So that tells me that it's likely that the things they've offered cooperation on have not contributed to ongoing portions of the investigation. Like they haven't given information that eventually is going to lead to somebody being charged. Because if they had, then you would expect their lawyers and the special prosecutor to want to wait until that played out. Because it makes a big difference in what credit you might get from a court for cooperation if you just talked to the special prosecutor once and nothing came of it, or if you provided information that led to a search warrant, that led to a charge, that led to a conviction.
You say that the prosecutor will have to describe to the judge the nature of their cooperation in order to inform the sentencing decision. Will that be public? Will we all hear from Mueller quite possibly well before the conclusion of his probe what the nature of the cooperation that he got from George Papadopoulos was?
No, not necessarily. So the prosecutor, there's a provision of the United States sentencing guidelines called 5K1 that specifically governs giving people credit under these Byzantine sentencing laws for their cooperation with the federal government. And it is not unusual at all with our ongoing investigations to make that presentation to the judge under seal and to even have the sentencing be a closed hearing when there is a discussion of the value of cooperation to an ongoing investigation.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We will have our regular Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday with Rich Lowry on the right and Annemarie Cox on the left. And these conversations with Ken White will be available as a new podcast we're calling LRC Presents All the President's Lawyers. To get all episodes, make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if there's something you've been wondering about the president, the porn star, and all the president's lawyers, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. This program is produced by Sarah Fay. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back on Friday with more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.